afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, February 16th, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger, and I will be your host today. And this will be a very important program because we're going to be going through some of the most recent statements from Lyndon LaRouche over the last 3 days. And we're also going to be talking about what you, the listener, need to know. This is not information. This is life and death matter in terms of the direction of policy. It's become increasingly clear to a growing number of those with the slightest grounding in reality that the present course of financial policy, the bailouts, the quantitative easing, and so on, is not only not working, but it has now gone beyond a boundary condition. It can't go further. And the hyperinflation which has resulted from the trillions of dollars of bailouts has increased the overall debt of the system to the point that it could never and will never be paid back. We've reached the condition that Lyndon LaRouche has been warning would occur unless his three-point plan, beginning with Glass-Steagall, were adopted. And that is that we face a complete and total breakdown of this bankrupt system. In his Friday Project webcast last night, and then in the discussion today, Mr. LaRouche took this further. He said there's a grouping among those who know this that's prepared to dump the bailout policy, to stop quantitative easing, maybe even dump Ben Bubbles Bernanke or Helicopter Bernanke, collapse the system, and then reorganize it, but providing wealth to a smaller number of privileged wealthy elite while leaving the rest of us to starve, to die of disease, or as the side effects of the general chaos which would ensue. This is the intent of the genocide faction, which is centered around Queen Elizabeth II and the British monarchy. It is also the policy of her puppet in the White House, Barack Obama. Now, there's another grouping which is not for genocide, which actually is responding to the question of Glass-Steagall. But they tend to be burrowed in the corners of the U.S. Congress. You find them in the commercial banking system, especially in the regional and smaller banks. There's some old-style industrialists out there, a handful left of productive unions. And they know that LaRouche's solution, beginning with Glass-Steagall, would work. But they've been isolated, and they've been terrified, and in many cases from threats directly coming from Obama or other thugs deployed by the British monarchy, the same monarchy which is preparing to let the whole thing crash. And this is the same grouping which has always opposed the reintroduction of Glass-Steagall, going back to Obama and Geithner's personal intervention against the McCain-Cantwell amendment to the Dodd-Frank bill, which would have included Glass-Steagall. Now, in the last days, Mr. LaRouche has called upon those of us who recognize that his solutions will work to escalate our mobilization for this legislative package. This is not just a package of some good ideas or a way to stem the bleeding. This is necessary for the United States to survive. Joining me on the program today will be two of the key people from our Percival team, people who are working both with LPAC TV to bring these solutions out to you on the website, and also they're organizing in Washington, D.C., hitting the institutions, trying to smoke out the good guys who are burrowed in the woodwork, and also to smoke out the bad guys, so that we can create a breakthrough in the Congress for these programs to be implemented. So we're at a point where there will be a reorganization in the near future. The question is, will it be an orderly reorganization around Glass-Steagall and a return to the credit system so we can rebuild our nation? Or will it be a chaotic collapse out of which will emerge a new financial system to benefit only the privileged, and to allow the circumstances which are already here in terms of food shortages, wars, and chaos to reduce the population of the planet? So Alicia Ceratani and Hector Rivas, I neglected to mention that these are the two from Percival who will be with us today. So Alicia and Hector, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Harley.
Thank you.
And I guess we talked briefly, and we decided Alicia would start. As you just heard, I opened with the general theme from Mr. LaRouche these past couple of days, but you've been in attendance in the meetings, you've been in the discussions. What can you add from the comments today that would give our activists a sense of what they need to know to take into battle this week?
Well, I think an important starting point is not necessarily something that's happened in the last couple of days, but looking back and looking at LaRouche's record and his forecasting of a process. And not coincidentally, we're coming up on the 30th anniversary of the Strategic Defense Initiative, which in many ways put LaRouche and his organization on the map. You can find on this website and the LPAC website the actual details of what LaRouche proposed with the Strategic Defense Initiative to the Soviets via President Reagan. But the important thing for us to note today is that LaRouche said were this proposal of mutually assured survival not taken up by the Soviets and the United States, the Soviet Union would collapse, and shortly thereafter the transatlantic system would collapse. And that's exactly what's happened. And LaRouche has warned throughout the decades that you cannot sustain a national economy or a global economy on fake money, that real wealth depends on scientific progress. And that's not any sort of, you know, in a certain sense, it's simple. It's much more simple than the way economy is discussed today. But the point is that we're at an absolute crisis point now, and this is something that LaRouche has warned about for about three decades now. And if people remember more recently in 2007, when the bailouts began in earnest, LaRouche had a webcast, July 25th, 2007, and he said explicitly, under no circumstances, under no governments, will this system be saved. And that's exactly what was attempted by this government in the United States and by Europe, ultimately steered from London, to bail out investment banks at the expense of nations. And we've reached a collapse point now where the bailout, the quantitative easing, as it's been known in the United States at least, is now about to be flipped inside out. And there have been a few very interesting warnings from people actually inside the industry in the last couple of days that indicate this is exactly what's going on. And a lot has been done from the industry to try to convince the Congress that that's not the case, but some people realize the implications of were we to continue with this Bernanke money printing. This would lead to a hyperinflationary situation that is far worse than what happened in Germany in 1923.
Alicia, on this, I understand this was part of the discussion today where Mr. LaRouche said that we've got to put out charts that show that the hyperinflation is not hypothetical, that the trillions of dollars are already in the system and are already affecting the price of food, the price of virtually everything.
Yeah, this is what he's referring to specifically, and this is the fun thing. We get to use the financial industry's own assessment here. This is Bill Gross, who people may know as the head of PIMCO, which is probably the largest bond trading entity on the planet.
Right.
Bill Gross just put out a February newsletter that warned of a credit supernova, which is a very appropriate analogy because you have something that is self-feeding and self-destructive at the same time. And he says, and I'll quote him, he says, each additional dollar of credit, which he's referring to as, you know, that's what a stimulus is, each additional dollar of credit seems to create less and less heat. In the 1980s, it took $4 of new credit to generate $1 of real GDP. Over the last decade, it has taken $10. And since 2006, $20 to produce the same result. So in their own terms, in the industry's own terms, you have a geometrical hyperinflationary pattern.
Right.
It's probably more than $20 at this point to create, you know, what they refer to as $1 of real GDP. And the point LaRouche has been making is that we're not going to be in a hyperinflationary dynamic. We're already locked into it now. And there have been other warnings. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to say there are other warnings from various Federal Reserve presidents in different locations throughout the country warning of this treasury bubble and asset bubbles. which could very easily move into something like a commodity bubble, a food inflation bubble. And the problem in Washington, D.C. And throughout the transatlantic is the majority of the financial industry is trying to keep this thing under wraps by just straight out lying, by just absolutely lying. For instance, the G20 finance ministers were all meeting in Moscow this weekend. Bernanke straight face said, we're going to continue a policy of monetary easing to stimulate growth in the American economy and maintain price stability. And so the majority of the industry is trying to keep this thing under wraps and explain it away, and it's getting very, very difficult to do that, which is why it's very useful that some people inside the industry are coming out and saying, hey, this is not sustainable, this thing is consuming itself. And the key thing in our work is to try to bring that message to Congress, who is, for whatever reason, always enamored when some quote-unquote economic expert opens their mouth and sort of cedes power to the authority that they shouldn't have, because frankly, these economic experts have just been wrong.
Including Bernanke, if you go back to the 2007-2008 Federal Open Market Commission transcripts. I was going to bring up, when you talked about this, I just saw a clip from CNBC, an interview of Alan Greenspan, who, when you talk about an economist is always wrong, he's at the top of the list, and yet they're still bringing him on to move his lips. And what he said is, don't worry about the sequester. The key question is, will the stock market keep going up? And he talked explicitly about what he calls the wealth effect, what you were saying earlier about fake money, that if people see the stock market going up, they'll spend money, and that is what leads to a recovery. So, you know, the guy who single-handedly mispredicted the bubble all the way, he created the bubble and said it wasn't a bubble, is continuing to say that. Now, Hector, do you have anything to add just from the discussions, particularly the discussion today?
Not anything too different. I mean, I would just stress that, you know, in the same light that from the forecast that Lynn had made back in the 1980s, I mean, that's what's really coming into a head now. Because if I have to stress anything that's notable in regards to getting this measure passed and the whole package that goes along with it in the federal government is an outright denial of reality that hyperinflation is already locked in. Everything that's been ongoing with the quantitative easing policy of the Fed for the last 2 years, I think that it's been an effect, has led us to this moment. And every decision that the Congress had made since 2007, you know, as Alicia had described, that they did precisely what Lynn said you should not do in the July 25th, 2007 webcast, which is try to save the system. And, you know, that's really what it boils down to, and that's what we have to crack. And they have to, our work really is to force them to see this beyond just a nice policy, but that this is a matter of life and death, not just in terms of individuals, although that is what we're facing. I mean, we are facing probably an immediate period, a situation where we just can't feed people because of the hyperinflation of prices and consumer goods. And I think most of the average citizen would have already recognized that when you look at, you know, just simple things like your grocery bill or your gas bills, just simple things that you need for basic survival between last year in 2011 to, you know, the end of 2012, in many cases these things have doubled, if not a little bit more. So the reality is that we're already geometrically going in a direction where the basic things that we need to survive are becoming much more difficult to attain. And the reality is not just where we are now, but where this thing can go in the immediate days and weeks ahead. And that's where we really have to crack through in the federal government, is to see that this is a life and death situation for every individual, but also a matter of, you know, of the perpetuity of the United States of America.
You see, this is where I think the forecasting question is so critical, because I was talking with someone today about this report of the price of chicken. You mentioned food. The price of chicken rose 21% from the end of 2011 to the end of 2012. And this person said, well, that's not hyperinflationary. Now, you know, it's not 2,000%. You can still probably skip 10 meals a week and afford a chicken dinner. But, you know, what we're seeing is a direction. And once the hyperinflation explodes, It's been described as the ketchup bottle phenomena, that, you know, you shake it and shake it and shake it and nothing happens, so you assume there's nothing in there. Next thing you know, it's all over your plate, your lap, the table, the floor. You can't control it. Now, I want to ask both of you, because I know you're both organizing in Congress. Both of you have said that we have to get across this idea that the system is finished. Now, a lot of our supporters are afraid to say that. They're afraid to bring it up because they think it sounds too radical or too extreme. But when you go in to organize, let me start with you, Hector. When you meet with people in congressional staffs, with people in the institutions in Washington, you tell them the system is finished, right?
Yeah, that's probably one of the first things we get into. I mean, because otherwise, then you're just starting the discussion in a false premise. If you're not starting from the discussion that what we're facing is the end of an entire era, an absolute end, you know, cold turkey, then everything you're going to be discussing within those parameters is just not going to be true. And I think the key thing is what we've been getting at is you have to, you know, what Lynn's been discussing, is you have to live in the future. The present is not the future. You have to say that the present is being determined by a future outcome. And right now, as it stands, when you look at the Federal Reserve policy, I mean, just look at the basics of what they do. Look at how, you know, look at the rate of time, for example, between the implementation of QE3 and QE4. Just look at that, right? And think about what was going on before that. Think about
right on top of each other.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much, yeah. I don't even think QE3 was active for more than 2 months before QE4 came right into the table, which doubled the amount of purchases that the Federal Reserve was making for these illicit assets, you know, basically, to the tune of, what, I think it was a doubling, if not a little bit more. But when you look at that, you have to see, where is this going? Don't see just what happened. You know, what happened is a shock, sure, but where is it going? What's the trajectory? And what you've seen as a trajectory from 2007 up to this moment has been an increasing amount of money, if it's even real, you know, just an increasing amount of commitment and obligations towards illicit funds, more and more in magnitude and shorter intervals of time.
And Alicia, so, when you say to people the system is finished, what's the usual response or the initial response?
It's denial. Mm-hmm. It's absolute denial. It's backpedaling. I mean, what's happening now in D.C. is that it's, you know, it's no longer a secret that the bailout process has been a disaster. I mean, it's even coming up in Senate and House hearings that the bailout has made a few banks bigger, consolidated the wealth into more risky banks, that the Dodd-Frank regulations have made it more difficult for smaller banks to do lending and to do business. So that's not news. The problem is that nobody seems to be prepared for a full-on paradigm shift. And that's where our job, this refrain that the system as they know it is finished and they should stop trying to regulate it, they should stop trying to bail it out. They should think of themselves living in a new system. And we've outlined that. Many people have outlined that. We've got the most concise, you know, mapped out policy for that in what LaRouche has proposed with this three-point program. But people don't want to admit we're headed for a huge paradigm shift. They're not prepared to say we need to scrap everything. And I'll just use the analogy of this meteorite that just hit in mm-hmm. Siberia, which is that at first you see this thing coming across the sky, right? It's you see things happening, people run to the window, but what the process is actually happening, then this thing is followed by a shock wave that comes and blows out the windows, blows down the doors, knocks down walls, and obliterates, you know, the city. What we're seeing right now is the bright light. We're seeing this meteor pass across the sky, and what's following in its wake is a shock wave. And that's what you're trying to communicate to people, is that the light and the shock wave are part of the same process. And they really have to think of them. They have to think of the present. They have to think of the future, determining what they're doing in the present. And there's a lot of propaganda, pressure, and other things to try to convince people otherwise. Because people know it's a mess.
Well, we've been given some very clear understanding of this from some the way people are backing off the issues? Or, I mean, are there a couple of examples you can give that, that show that people who know better are still pulling their punches?
Yeah, take the, I mean, Glass-Steagall is, we've saturated the concept of Glass-Steagall on both houses to the point where we have a bill in the House. We've got, you know, people excited about it in the Senate. But in comes this idea of separating the banks by size by Sherrod Brown and a couple of others. There are these alternative proposals that don't quite go all the way. We don't quite have to reform the whole thing. Let's just regulate the system. We don't have to gut it and create something new. And, you know, when push comes to shove, a lot of these well-intended people are saying, well, maybe we don't have to go all the way. Maybe we should give the Volcker rule a couple more months to pan out and see if it'll work, which is what Elizabeth Warren, who campaigned on Glass-Steagall, this is what she said recently. So the water has been muddied around these diversionary ideas or proposals, which are only reactions to a poor system. They're not positive proposals for a new system. They're just reactions to something. The reactions to a catastrophe that has occurred, which in no way reorganize anything.
It's the classic reorganization of the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
And Hector, you've seen some of this also, the retreat, the fear, the cowardice, but you've also seen that people are much more serious about these discussions, aren't they?
Yeah, actually. I mean, that's the thing to really keep in mind is that this is a real fight, both within Washington and outside of the Beltway. I mean, there's a sense of this. There's a really good interview that one of our top organizers, Tim Rush, just did this afternoon regarding his work and other collaborators of his throughout the country and getting these state representatives who are feeling, you know, the in front of the doors reality of the hyperinflation and everything that's going on with the economy. And that has been extremely fruitful in terms of our work also being fed into Washington. But, you know, when you think of it, you think, for example, in the Senate, you know, you consider the fact that in 2010, you know, there was an amendment made by Cantwell and McCain, this is a bipartisan in this case, to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. That received tremendous pressure from the Obama administration to completely shut down. And the reality, you know, with what's going on today, I mean, one of the readings that we've gotten is one of the reasons why we do not have some of the about 80 to 85 co-sponsors that signed on to the previous bill under the 112th Congress immediately, which they should have, is pressure from the Obama administration. Now, why would that be happening other than the fact that there is fear from the White House that we could win? And the fear comes from the fact there is a momentum and a recognition amongst a relatively few amount of people, or maybe more for all I know, that understand that this is a measure that has to be taking place. And, you know, you can think about what's broken out in the Senate in the last week. For example, I mean, for one thing, you know, you have Agnes King, who came in from Maine, who said that re-implementing the Glass-Steagall Act is one of his dream acts. You have Elizabeth Warren, who made this a big portion of her campaign after the fall of the, I think, the $11 billion blowout of J.P. Morgan. This past week, you know, you had Senator Manchin, I believe, at a banking committee, ask very direct questions, why not Glass-Steagall? If you all realize that deregulation has led to this collapse, why aren't we discussing Glass-Steagall? At the same time, another senator who won, I think, in Nevada, based on campaigning for Glass-Steagall, was challenged in an editorial by the Las Vegas Review-Journal, you know, with the title, Where Does Heller Stand Now in Restoring Glass-Steagall? So there is a grouping, there is an understanding, and there is a real fight to make this policy go through.
There was also Maria Cantwell raised this with Jack Lew, the Obama choice for Treasury Secretary. And
Lew
basically said, as Cantwell put it, so essentially you're saying no Glass-Steagall. But now, I assume on the website, we're putting up, I saw in our briefing, the list of congressmen who signed the original Marcy Kaptur bill who have not signed on to the new one. Is that list up on our website?
Yeah, it should be under the Glass-Steagall page. We're putting together a whole basically organizing package, and part of that includes a editorial that Leandra Bernstein just completed, which is, it really, what makes it move is that it's action-oriented, and that we've been systematically going back through to the former co-sponsors, getting them back on H.R. 129, and then getting a host of new signers, including a lot of Republican support, which is ironically what we're getting from the state level support on Glass-Steagall,
right,
which Hector said, mentioned briefly, that one of our leading organizers here in Virginia, Tim Rush, has been doing a bunch of state work in different state capitals, getting different members, senators and members of the House at the state level to introduce resolutions in support of the federal H.R. 129. A lot of that support is coming from Republicans, which is very interesting because it's almost as if inside the Beltway it's a different state of matter. There's just different physical laws that apply to the politics inside the Beltway, which it really shouldn't be because the country is saying something much different than what's happening inside in D.C. But what we've done successfully is use things like the website, use the fact that we have a national organization, a whole team of activists that are bringing to bear their work and leveraging that inside Washington, D.C. And that has worked to great effect in the last session, and we plan on kicking that up a notch in this 113th session because there's a lot more we have to do. People now think they understand what Glass-Steagall is because we've really made this thing a household name. The reason why it's being discussed in the Senate, the reason why it's being discussed in the House is because the work we've done nationally on this thing. But the problem is that people think they understand what it is, and they don't yet get the idea that we need to force through a paradigm shift, that what is possible today, or let's say what's impossible today, will suddenly be possible tomorrow. And because the fact of the matter is we are headed for hyperinflation, and if we continue on this track, there will be no United States. There will be no U.S. dollar. And people really have to sit down and let that sink in personally. And then what we're proposing in terms of Glass-Steagall, national credit system, big infrastructure like NWAPA will make sense. And that's the job of every American. That's the job of every single American, no matter who you are, where you live. And that's the beauty of having the representative government that we have. And you might think we are at a severe disadvantage. I'll say one great advantage we do have is we have what the Founding Fathers created, which is a representative government where the average citizen can participate in a national discussion. And that is incredibly powerful at this point. So I would encourage people to use the LaRouche PAC website as a tool for updates, but also print off material. And it just provides an overall mapping of how to leverage what's going on nationally into the Capitol.
You're listening to Alicia Ceratani and Hector Rivas, two leaders of the LaRouche PAC team out of Purcellville, Virginia, that have been taking on this challenge of moving the Congress, and today appealing to you, the listener, to get off your whining high chairs and get out there and organize. You know, when I do meetings all the time, people say, oh, you can't beat them, you'll never win. And I say, well, what are you doing? What have you been doing to try? And you find out that people are stuck in the old paradigm, as you say. Now, I'd like to, Hector, since Alicia just brought this up, this question of our deployment, I'd like you to give the listeners a sense of what we're doing now from Virginia, both from Purcellville and Leesburg, the deployment into Washington. And then I want to get from there to the discussion of what the listeners should be doing to help us to open up these congressional offices. So what does it look like? What have we been doing?
Well, I think one of the powerful things and exciting things that we've been doing as part of our work into Washington from here has been what we call the constituent calls. And it's given us the opportunity to work with the activists, people who, like yourself, who are listening to this program, who want to do something, who've met us at some location, I don't know whether it's the Home Depot or the post office in Massachusetts and whatnot, but you can use us as a vehicle to get your message and your determination to preserve this country through into Washington. I mean, a lot of the meetings, though not exclusively, that we've been able to set up, where we've had the opportunity to really, really challenge the immortality of the staffers of the office we met with, you know, given the time, 30 minutes to 45 minutes or so, depending on how long it lasts, to really go through the devastation of the reality of the situation, what we're expecting from them, et cetera, has been through the assistance, largely in part, of these constituent calls, activists who have done joint work with us to help set up a meeting with their representative's office. And that has had a very powerful effect. And I can give one solid example of a California representative who, you know, we ourselves had been interacting and interfacing with and challenging for months during the 112th Congress. And we were consistently told, yes, for it, you know, the typical, we're behind this. And it wasn't until we got one of our activists involved, particularly with me in this case, and that really, you know, stuck a pitchfork where it needed to go and got the representative to jump and sign on to the bill, which is what we need them to do, is to actually put their names, but really their passion behind it. And so that's one specific way that people who are listening to this program can get immediately involved. You know, reach out to one of us in the organization here out of Percival. We're doing the work in D.C. to help fight to get these members of Congress to meet with us in person. Now, while we do that, we should just be conscious that while we're out there, we're at the same time on our own interfacing with these representatives face-to-face. I mean, we meet them in the hallways. We meet them in events. We meet them right as they're coming out to vote, which is usually in the hundreds. And, you know, we keep putting the fire to them, you know, into their morality, that this is something that they have to take up immediately and just keep holding them to it. So it's a bit of a, I would call it a pincer effect, where we get them face-to-face, but also with what the activists can do with doing joint work with us is to challenge their offices and their staffers to really fundamentally take this up as an immortal act. Say, you know, in a time like this, you're going to put everything you have on the line. We're asking you to you know, sacrifice your job if that's what it takes.
Now, Alicia, just to follow through on this, you know, there are these lobbying groups which will get thousands of emails that are form letters into the Congress. But I assume you can say from personal experience that when you have a person in a district who really wants to get a bill passed and who makes calls and visits the office, it does lead to a response in Washington, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, we've been able to do a number of meetings just ourselves here on the policy, on Lynn's forecast and the policy, but once we started getting constituents from all over the country to write to the offices and say, look, this policy outlined by LaRouche Peck is life or death for the nation. And they articulate in their own words why this has to be taken up and followed through. I mean, it does make all the difference in the world. I was working with a fellow in Alaska, and he, you know, he wrote one of the most poetic appeals to his Congress. It's the whole delegation in Alaska, which is three people, two senators and a congressman, very poetic appeal to just seriously considering championing the Glass-Steagall and reconstruction of the physical economy of the United States. And bam, there were three meetings. Well, there were two meetings and a follow-up, so three total. And this is, people should not underestimate the power of the right ideas in a crisis and the inherent structure of the government for the, you know, well-intended citizens with the right, with powerful ideas to move things. There are hundreds of stories we could go through where that is exactly the case. But the situation, the one case in Alaska that I just referred to was incredibly effective, and it opened up something in Washington D.C. It opened up doors in Washington D.C. that weren't open before.
Well, this is important because, on the one hand, it starts with the individual making a decision that they understand what Mr. LaRouche is saying, that there is no further direction of survival under bailouts, that we have to move into a new system. Now, once you get that point, and if you don't have it, if you haven't figured it out, get on the website, talk to whoever you talk to in the organization, figure it out. But once you get it, organize others to join you with calls, to join you with delegations to congressional offices or town meetings. But, you know, we have not really had that kind of mobilization as a consistent force yet. We're seeing potential for it. We're seeing developments around it. But I think from what the two of you are saying, it does work, and it's got to just be more intense. We saw, for example, I think a third of the South Dakota legislature has now signed on to a resolution for Glass-Steagall there, and it's the result of a consistent effort by a handful of our activists who are, you know, very used to doing this, but they're not just doing it by rote or by memory. They're reviving and rethinking every single day how to do it. Now, I have another question that came to me from one of the contacts who said that they're not sure how to answer a specific objection they got from their congressional office, which was a Texas congressional office, where the person said basically what Jack Lew said. Well, Glass-Steagall was good in its time, but it's anachronistic. We now have new forms of financial activity, and that if we don't have an openness to these new forms of risk and speculation, then the United States will be left in the cold by the rest of the world. I'm sure you've heard some variant of that. How do you guys answer that?
Well, I think one fun way, the way it was answered, was by Senator Manchin in the Senate Banking Committee on Financial Reform. When he was told the same thing, I forget who it was by, one of these top regulators.
The Federal Reserve guy.
Yeah, right, Tarullo. And Manchin said, so you're saying that we repealed Glass-Steagall because we repealed the rule that they would have broken if we didn't repeal it so that they could just go and speculate. And this is the thing. People say, oh, Glass-Steagall doesn't keep up with the complexity of today's system. And this is the problem with Dodd-Frank, too, is that it's so complex. They're trying to regulate a dead system. I mean, think of the kind of work you'd have to put into the kind of medical procedures you'd have to construct to keep a dead person alive. They'd be pretty complex. That's what Dodd-Frank is. So this idea that the financial system today is so complex and we just, you know, Glass-Steagall isn't complex enough for it. It's not complex. It's dead. And they're trying harder and harder to keep the thing alive. It's like building epicycles upon epicycles to give the appearance that this thing is still alive. Instead, when someone says, oh, this is outdated, say, no, it's not outdated. The system that they're putting, the system that is now in place right now is outdated. This thing is dead. We're not going to try to regulate it. We're going to gut the thing, shut it down, and replace it with something that actually makes money. Because that's another irony. These economists and investment bankers are really bad at making money. If they were good at it, they wouldn't have to come to the U.S. taxpayers and the Federal Reserve and the federal government to ask us to bail them out. They have no authority whatsoever. The complex system that they claim, you know, they need the federal government to keep up complex regulations with is a joke. It doesn't work. It's never created real wealth for America. And that can be easily demonstrated by going through the territories of the United States and seeing that we've become less productive as a whole across all industries as the financial sector has risen. And there is no argument to say that the investment banking, financial services industry creates wealth, and that's why you can't shut it down. Because if it creates so much wealth, why are we bailing it out?
You know, I think a perfect example of this is the case of J.P. Morgan Chase, which is holding over $70 trillion worth of derivative obligations on their books. Now, that's more than four times the size of the current GDP. And J.P. Morgan Chase claims to be doing quite well. But all it would take would be one wrong bet to have that start unravel. And this is where you'll see the super hyperinflation, because there's no way to stop it. The debt is so large. Now, Hector, I'd like you to answer, if you can, one of the other objections. Well, we had to do it in the United States because they were deregulating in Europe, and we would lose out to the European banks if we didn't move away from from Glass-Steagall and from regulation. How do you answer that?
Well, I mean, it doesn't sound too different than we have to move into more complex modes of financial generation. And I have to say, you know, let's just be honest. What you're talking about, when you mean by complexity, you mean making it easier to steal. That's the bottom line of what happened. And the way to really understand that is let's just look at the facts. Glass-Steagall, to have it taken down, did not happen in 1999. It happened in 1985. And a certain way you can say started the very day that President Franklin Roosevelt died. But going back to 1985, why do I say that? Well, I think we should remember, and we've had published a documentary on this on the LaRouchePAC.com website in 2010. But the fact is that when Alan Greenspan was one of the executive directors or directors of J.P. Morgan Bank, investment bank, they wrote a document, an internal document for J.P. Morgan titled Rethinking Glass-Steagall. And the very thing that congressman or that office told you about complexities and deregulation, got to compete with the European markets, that's exactly what Alan Greenspan said in that pamphlet.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to just be cognizant about who is this guy, right? Who are these people? What is J.P. Morgan as an institution? J.P. Morgan as an institution is what made Adolf Hitler possible. J.P. Morgan as an institution and that whole Wall Street gang is what made Mussolini possible. It made fascism possible. So when you hear those kinds of arguments, you're listening to a fascist. And if the fascist tells you or Hitler comes up to you and says, hey, look, I want to be friends, don't turn your back.
You know, on the same track, of course, you have the other line that always comes out, which is that this is too complex for most Americans to understand. And I think this is where we've seen a major part of the brainwashing, where the American people, who generally are somewhat skeptical, and they think, well, if something seems too good to be true, it probably is. And yet they got sucked into the housing bubble. They got sucked into the dot-com bubble. They're being sucked into the stock market bubble today. And I think this is one of the important things that Lyndon LaRouche has been saying, is we have to tell people to stop being stupid and learn to think.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a new paper out on that, doesn't he?
Yeah. You know, one thing I would say is I think this is the importance of Glass-Steagall Plus, as LaRouche called it not too long ago. You know, and I know it was stressed earlier about the, you know, it's not just Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall itself is not going to bring an economic recovery. It will stop the bleeding. But what has to go immediately with Glass-Steagall is the drive, the creation of a credit system, which, you know, Michael Kirsch has done a lot of work on the national bank, that whole business. But the overall intention being improving and empowering the productivity of the land, which is what NWAPA serves as an example. You know, because what you're really addressing here is that to really challenge this, when it gets thrown out our ways, we have to be conscious of what ruined ourselves. Because you're right, hundreds of people, if not more, got themselves involved in the real estate bubble. They got themselves involved in the iTech bubble. And I'm from California, so I remember when that whole thing, you know, was radical in people's minds. But we gave into, in ourselves, a false idea of what is an economy. It was short-sighted. It was immediate. It was pleasure-seeking. And it wasn't what does the nation as a whole need to improve its state of function over the next 25 to 50 years.
Yeah, well, I just want to add something
on,
because I'm really glad you brought that up, Hector. The tendency in the United States right now is to point at the banking community and say, you know, you screwed us, you guys are the robbers, you're the stealers. But that's not entirely accurate. Because there was a there was an opportunism inside the American people that said, oh, I'm going to make some money on this. This is how I'm going to make, I can make a lot of money on this, and I can take advantage of this. And if we learn anything, if the American people culturally learn anything from what could still end up being a very devastating lesson, it's that you don't tolerate that because you have to think in terms of what is good for the next generation. And you have to, people have to sort of steel themselves from these temptations and say, no, I'm above that. I'm an American citizen. I don't fall for robbery, highway robbery. No, thank you. I don't want anything to do with what this investment banking community is trying to pull over on us. And it's that vulnerability in the American people that gave these guys some of their power. And that is, I know that's a difficult thing to say to an American people who have had most of their industry taken from them, their family farms stripped from them, their space program stripped from them. But that is, none of those things are an excuse to condone what this investment banking community, through the approval and consent of our members of Congress, have done. And that's the turnaround. That's going to be the margin of success. And I think this gets back to the people listening and the people recognizing that something has to change, actually doing something. That's going to be the margin of difference, is that people take personal responsibility for changing U.S. and world history by pushing through a paradigm shift now inside the United States, beginning with this three-point program that we've outlined, that LaRouche has prescribed.
And that's why Lynn talks a lot about the 5%, that you don't need a majority of people to figure this out. There are plenty of people who now know that either they were suckered by these policies or they knew they were wrong, but they did nothing. And that 5% is a critical margin right now. Mm-hmm. We have about 15 minutes left, a little less than that, and I wanted to get to one other side of this, and I'd like to hear from both of you on it. We've seen a little bit of pushback from the Congress recently. You mentioned the Manchin, Cantwell. There were a few others on the Glass-Steagall issue. But we're also seeing it around the drone policy, and we're seeing it around Benghazi. And the word impeachment is beginning to get out there a little bit more. And again, people tend to get too caught up in details and specifics, and they're missing the broader policy. For example, the Obama policy of allying himself with an Anglo-Saudi terror operation, that's what's behind Benghazi, that's what's behind Syria, that's what's behind these various things. It's not the specific. But I want to ask both of you, are we beginning to see what you think is the potential in the Congress to break with this idea that whatever we do in the so-called war on terrorism is acceptable and the president has a right to kill Americans?
Well, to be totally honest, one of the things that Mr. LaRouche said today, this morning in a meeting, was that despite the good work that is being done on a handful of senators and a few Congress people demanding clarity on what happened in Benghazi and what is the Obama administration covering up, despite the good work that's being done, if these guys don't come out on stopping a killer hyperinflationary policy, then a lot of that work is for naught. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to make light of a very serious fight that is being waged on both sides of the aisle in both houses, because it's very significant. But Mr. LaRouche is an economic forecaster who has been right 11 times out of 10 here at this point. And this warning on hyperinflation and the role of the U.S. Congress to intervene on what the executive branch is doing, the administration is doing via the Fed and the Treasury, really is the top priority. And there is a tendency to try to run with the things that are popular. And this Benghazi thing is incredibly popular because the implications are huge. Mm-hmm. But when you get right down to it, what makes the Benghazi cover-up so damning is that it's a British-Saudi operation who is funded by the same banks that are running the bailout. And it goes right to the issue of a paradigm shift. And until these senators and congressmen begin speaking in those terms, the enemies will have an advantage on us. They will be working faster and harder than we are, and we will not overwhelm what could very easily blow up in, you know, as a hyperinflationary spiral.
Hector, did you want to say something on that?
The only thing I was going to add was, you know, we had seen, yes, pushback on that level. You know, for example, with Wyden and challenging the drone policy and the whatever legal basis that the administration is secretly containing to assassinate American citizens. I think the bottom line is what was even being raised here is, you know, between that and just the reality of the fact that the entire world is about to implode, is there's a hesitancy that I don't think needs to be there. I think at this point, this administration has violated the Constitution, violated basic law, both, you know, national and international, that it's enough to have indicated that this guy is a threat. He's a threat to the country. I mean, the fact that he has been key in pushing back, scaring off, bullying, threatening, for all I know, members of Congress and the Senate to not go with Glass-Steagall at a point where we desperately need it, and it's a matter of life and death, is enough to say then you'll work for some other society, some other class that is not in the interest of the United States. It's about to destroy us all. You have to be impeached. You have to go. And until the Congress decides, any member of Senate, any member of the House decides to go at that level, at the level of saying, look, you either do this or you're out tomorrow, then we're lacking the real gravity of discussion that has to be occurring in Washington. You know, at this point, I think it's just absolutely ridiculous that he's been president this long. I think it's absolutely ridiculous that he even made it for a second term. The guy mentally is a deranged person, and he's not somebody who we should give the keys to take care of our children, so to speak.
Well, let me bring up the other side of this, which both of you have just mentioned, which is one of the things that a lot of people are afraid to talk about, which is the idea of the British monarchy, that there is a leading force on this planet that's committed to depopulation, that one of their key representatives is Tony Blair, who I think what ties together the policy of globalization, deregulation, and hyperinflation with war is Blair's insistence that the era of Westphalia is over, that the era of the sovereign nation state is over, and therefore all power is going to be ceded to this financial oligarchy. When you talk to people in the Congress and bring up the British monarchy, the British Empire, the genocide policy, what kind of reaction do you get to that?
Well, I can say initially that, you know, some people have a sense of that already. And while it might be taboo to discuss it in those terms, ultimately that assessment of it that you just gave, Harley, is the only way all of this stuff makes sense for people. You know, some people don't want to go there. Maybe they think it's a little esoteric. Oh, these are conspiracies. But the people who are serious had either thought of something like that and didn't have all the specifics, or have something to contribute and say, yeah, I've seen this, for instance, with Tony Blair. Yeah, I've seen this policy of interventionism since, you know, the Clinton, you know, Bosnia thing, that was a total shift in U.S. foreign policy. Oh yeah, that is the Tony Blair doctrine, juxtaposed to what other nations are doing and the criticism from other nations in the U.N. Security Council, and then you suddenly have the idea that's generating all of these other effects that we would otherwise take up as issues. And you know, the most provocative one, which LaRouche made a big emphasis last night in the webcast and again this morning, is that really the hyperinflationary policy of the Fed has nothing to do with banks, has nothing to do with fiscal policy or monetary policy. It's a policy of depopulation. And it's only when you can ever discuss these things in those terms that there is a real force of evil on the planet. And it's the form of that evil has taken the shape of imperial systems, which LaRouche has identified that have gone all the way back to the Roman Empire. Until you can discuss history and humanity in those terms, a lot of these things become issues. And when you really come to grips with that, then you can get some traction. Then what we're proposing is like, oh, yeah, of course we would want to bankrupt a bunch of speculators and regain our sovereignty over our national economy. Oh, yeah, of course we have to shut down people like Tony Blair, who's trying to start a world war when the whole financial system's coming down and the transatlantic system would lose all its fiscal power. That's what I'd have to add. That's been my experience on Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's important because I think, as Hector was just saying, there's no reason to hold anything back. What are you going to hold back? Are you worried that you might not sound credible to a congressional aide who is making excuses for Obama or making excuses for a dysfunctional Republican Party? There's no reason to hold back. Now, Hector, we just have a few minutes left, and I'd like you to restate the case again for why the people on listening to this program should be mobilized first thing Monday morning. In fact, they should use tomorrow to mobilize others to join them. But to get on the phone to their congressman, what's at stake here? Why do they have to do this?
Well, I think where I would start is, you know, there's this story that I really like of this woman who walked up to Benjamin Franklin after the Constitutional Convention and asked him what kind of government they had created for us. And his famous reply was, a republic, if you can keep it. And I think that what we should be conscious of, what's at stake here is not just whether you're going to have a house or not, or a car, or, you know, food, all these things that we definitely do need, but there's a much stronger existential question that's involved here, and that's the perpetuity of the nation. Whether this nation, the great experiment of America, which had been a long fight amongst humanists for 2,000 years worth of documented history, from anything you can read from Plato's Republic to the work of Dante Alighieri to the work of Cusa to make the voyage into the West possible, that's at stake. Everything is up for grabs. What we face if we don't maintain the perpetuity of the nation, not just the loss of the nation, but it's the morality of the world. And the consequence of that is a 21st century new dark age. It's conditions that I don't think many people even want to begin to imagine, that we'll be plunging not only ourselves, as we are in it currently, but for whatever posterity, if it even exists, into the future. What we're facing as it stands now is a question of whether the human species itself would continue to exist. We face the possible extinction of the human race. You know, we haven't touched on this so much, but here's the fact. We either get an economic recovery or this whole system blows out, and what goes along with it is war. And in an age where the major powers of the planet possess thousands of thermonuclear warheads, that's not the kind of world you really want to get into, and it's not the kind of gamble you want to make. And why have that when here we stand in the United States of America, the pillar of hope, the hope of the planet, the pillar of morality, right, as it's stated in our very own Constitution for the defense, tranquility, and prosperity of the people of the nation, and as how we are to extend ourselves abroad. We have one of the most beautiful constitutions and nations that this planet had ever produced. Why lose it? For fear of not being popular, for fear of not being accepted. Why does that matter when your immortality is at stake? And I think for that reason, for that really high, profound concept, that's why people should get involved with us starting tomorrow into Monday to start setting up meetings in the Congress, doing their own work, writing letters, calling their state representatives to get behind this fight.
And let me just add, get on the LaRouche PAC website, LaRouchePAC.com, where you have this kind of material. You have the latest from LaRouche. You have the updates, the regular updates, as well as special reports. And we do have, again, the Glass-Steagall section. We'll have an organizing tools that you'll need. So, look, I think we're just about out of time. I'd like to thank Alicia Saratani and Hector Rivas for joining us. I would just say to the people listening to this program that they're not just flapping their jaw. They're standing up and living what they're talking about, living in history. You change history by living in the future, but you can't change history by sitting on your rear end and complaining. And we've laid out a perspective now, the Glass-Steagall Plus, and we encourage you to join us immediately with that. And then we'll be back next week with another edition of the LaRouche Show. But you've got your work in front of you. Get at it. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you next week.